This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and welcome to our Christmas Eve edition of the show. This hour, we will revisit conversations from our show revolving around one theme, charity. Because this year, perhaps more than any other in recent memory, we are all looking to find solace in the generosity and helpfulness of those around us, even if at a distance. In the last few months on this show, we have heard so many times about the need and those meeting the challenge, from our reporters, experts and organizers, faith leaders, politicians, frontline workers, and so many callers.
Times of crises are really the times when people really step up. That's just what happens, and we're seeing that now more than ever.
Yes, I am a medical worker, and my older neighbor came up to me when I was getting my mail yesterday and asked me if I had the mask, because he didn't have any, and he wants to protect himself and his other older family members if he has to, you know, make shopping runs or pharmacy runs. And so I was able to provide that for him, and it made me feel good to be able to help him.
Our organization is connecting individuals to food, both in the immediate term, but also food sources to ensure that they're able to access food in the days and weeks and months to come.
We need to start funding initiatives and policies and interventions that actually looks at healthy food access as we do healthcare and medicine, a necessity for long life.
People have been calling us, like, kind of really like begging for the food. You know, some people, they are unable to come to our pantry because we open Wednesdays and Fridays. But what I can say is we're doing a great work. We're doing a very, very awesome job, but it's a challenge for all of us.
It makes me feel ashamed. I mean, we live in the richest country in the history of the world, and we have tens of millions of people who are hungry. And we had a hunger problem well before this pandemic. But this pandemic just blew the lid off of the crisis.
As we've seen, the pandemic has disrupted our economy and left millions of Americans without work, many struggling to put food on the table for themselves and their families. We are reminded that even in good economic times, budgets are tight and so many of our neighbors go without. Yet last year, the Trump administration proposed a dramatic cut to the SNAP program, often referred to as food stamps, which would have cut food support for some 700,000 Americans. The pandemic upended those cuts, and at the end of October of this year, a federal judge blocked the administration from making them at all. And it's unlikely the new Biden administration will take up the mantle of those cuts. But again, the experience of those struggling with food insecurity is more pronounced than in recent memory. And so we want to revisit a conversation we had last summer, before the pandemic, about what SNAP means to Massachusetts and what cuts to the program would mean. We spoke with Vicky Negus, a policy advocate with the Massachusetts Law Reform Institute, and with Shannon Uramchek, who once relied on SNAP to feed her family. Shannon now helps feed others as a board member at the Food Bank of Western Massachusetts. We began with Shannon's story and what it's like to rely on SNAP.
The SNAP program is such an amazing, wonderful program for Americans all over the country. And the hardship is not so much, you know, getting those SNAP benefits. It's when those benefits are lost or change, you know, there's a change in your benefits or something else drastic happens. And so for my experience, depending on SNAP benefits was really the only way that I could feed my family in the years that I was homeless and struggling to get back on my feet.
So, Shannon, you say it's when you lose something. Can you explain that to us a little bit better? What do you mean by when you lose something, and how does SNAP step in and fill those gaps?
What I mean by that is when you are at the very bottom, you have no income, you have no resources, you have nothing, right? At that time, the state and sometimes the federal government, in the case of SNAP, steps in and offers you benefits to get you back on your feet. What sometimes happens is the threshold for any other income is so low that, you know, the minute you start making anything to sort of pull yourself out of that hole, you start losing benefits. So that it's sort of this vicious cycle of, you know, just barely getting by or not getting by at all.
And you lose benefits because your income means that you don't qualify for those benefits anymore?
Yeah, so The idea of SNAP and also, you know, other DTA benefits is to get you back on your feet. So they give you the SNAP benefits to feed your family during the time that you're not working. At the point where you finally start, you know, getting a job and start working, you almost immediately lose most, if not all, of your SNAP benefits pretty quickly. And it's figuring out how to then compensate for that money, really, using a paycheck, a regular paycheck. In my case, you know, I was in shelter. And so when I finally was able to secure work, I had to work on getting out of shelter and getting into an apartment. And then I had housing expenses, and I had utility expenses, and phone expenses, and vehicle expenses, at the same time that my SNAP benefits were being decreased and mostly within a few months cut completely. So then I was like, okay, so I have this little bit of money that I've made from my job, and now I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to continue to keep food in the house without the SNAP benefits.
And what did you do?
Food banks, food pantries, because at one point I was receiving, you know, approximately $700 a month in food stamps, food benefits. And I have four children, so it was a family of five. When I no longer received benefits anymore, I had to try to figure out how was I going to use my, you know, my income, which was probably only twice what my food stamps were originally, and try to figure out how I was going to pay my bills and buy food. So I spent a lot of times at the pantries. I took whatever they would give to us, and I tried to make my food dollars stretch as far as I could.
Thanks
and
for
sometimes
sharing.
There were decisions that had to be made. You know, I'm not going to pay the phone bill this month because I need to buy groceries, and groceries are more important than phone.
So that sounds incredibly stressful, Shannon. And I want to bring Vicki Negus in here, because the thing you're talking about, there's a name for it, Vicki, right? Which is the cliff effect.
The cliff effect, yeah.
So Vicki, tell us about the cliff effect, and tell us what the USDA is proposing to do with SNAP and how it affects that.
Yeah, absolutely. And Shannon, thank you so much for sharing that story, because I think it really gives some great context for the consequences of what this proposed rule from the Trump administration would do. So as Shannon kind of said, there are really strict eligibility limits for SNAP already in place. In Massachusetts, you know, in order to recognize the kind of reality of life for working families who are trying to move ahead and move forward, we know that it's really difficult for working families to do that without a little bit of added benefit to help put food on the table. So in Massachusetts, you know, we, along with many other states, we have an income limit over which families are not eligible for this program. And the Trump administration is seeking to restrict the flexibility that states have and what that limit is. So just as an example, to give some kind of concrete numbers about what that would look like, you know, in Massachusetts, if a family is of three, was earning, a mom and two kids, was earning $27,000 a year. Right now, and under the proposed rule, they would continue to be eligible for SNAP. But if that mom started working a little bit more, just a tiny bit more, and started earning $27,500 in 1 year, they would no longer be eligible for any SNAP benefit. Mm-hmm. And that would put that family at a much higher risk of food insecurity, which has lots of other really bad impacts in addition to just being hungrier.
So $500 of increased income would essentially lead to the entire elimination of the SNAP benefit for a family. Is that what you're saying?
Correct.
So Shannon, when you eventually transitioned off of SNAP into full economic self-sufficiency, how did that happen? What changed in your life that you became fully economically self-sufficient, if that's the way you would describe it?
I wish I could say it was the system. I wish I could say that they supported me in a way that gave me enough access to resources that I could pull myself out. But unfortunately, that wasn't the case. I kind of had to scrape and claw my way little by little by little. And I was fortunate in that I had come from a background. I'm well-educated. And I had a master's degree. I had a career before, you know, I was in shelter. And so I had the advantage that I could at least figure out what was happening, where the resources were. But it's a long process. I went into shelter in 2013, and I was there for 2 years. And then it took another 6 months after I started working to be able to finally transition out of the shelter into my own apartment. And at that point, I should have had, you know, a stabilization worker or somebody. I never met anybody. What? So I literally had to figure out for myself, and I cut corners here and there, and I didn't have internet for a long time, and I didn't have cable for a long time, and we only had, I had one phone line, one cell phone line for a long time. And so that's how I was able to get to a place where I could feel a little bit more stable. And I worked hard at my job. Yeah. And I decided to go back to school. And so those are some things that I did. And those weren't things that were encouraged by programs or by the system or by anyone who was supposed to be helping, you know, transition me into a place of self-sufficiency.
You really did that.
Those
were
things that I just figured out to do.
All right. So, Vicki, we've just heard that from Shannon. It doesn't sound like anyone's disputing that wanting to move to self-sufficiency is everybody's objective. It does sound like what you're saying is that the policy objective may not necessarily be wrong, but that you're saying this policy proposal in particular isn't going to work. And right. We're hearing from Shannon, hey, I had to do a lot of this on my own and scrounge, and I had made some smart investments, and I had to teeter on the edge for a long time. So, Vicki, what is a better way to ease people off SNAP?
Yeah, I think that's a really good and a really important question. And I think that, you know, if the Trump administration really cared to make sure that low-wage working families were able to move forward in a way that was sustainable and long-term and ongoing, then, you know, we would have more investment in jobs that had living wages and continuity of hours. You know, we have a gig economy where folks, their hours go up, they go down on a regular basis, and it's very difficult to plan and have consistency when those hours fluctuate that much. We have a huge problem with access to affordable childcare. Certainly in Massachusetts, that's a major issue.
We are one of the most, if not the most expensive state in the country for infant child care.
We have the second most expensive cost, yeah, for infant child care nationally. So again, there's an area where if we were serious about trying to tackle hunger and trying to tackle food insecurity and poverty, there are much better ways of doing it that don't involve taking food off of the table of tens of thousands of working families in our state.
I think what Vicki says is 100% true. I feel like the only way to really end hunger is to really take a holistic approach to lots of other determinants: education, jobs, careers, how much life skills a family has. So I really feel like structuring the system so that it answers all of these other issues. You know, there are so many barriers to an individual becoming self-sufficient, and it's not just about food, and it's not just about cash money. It's about resources, it's about education, it's about finding the right jobs and the right certifications and the right trainings and providing people with financial literacy skills and making sure that they do have their child care in place and that kind of thing. So if it's not a holistic approach and it's not tackling all of these other factors of for food insecurity, then I don't really feel like we're really doing much of anything except continuing in the same vein.
That's Shannon Yaramchuk, who once relied on SNAP to feed her family. Shannon now helps feed others as a board member at the Food Bank of Western Massachusetts. And Vicki Negus, a policy advocate with the Massachusetts Law Reform Institute. Now again, those proposed Trump administration SNAP cuts have been delayed by the pandemic and by order of a federal judge. And we spoke last summer, before the pandemic and before the number of people in our state who struggle with hunger hit 1 in 6, 1 million of our family members, neighbors, friends, and colleagues. In April of this year, the Greater Boston Food Bank distributed the most food in its 40-year history, almost 10 million pounds. And the work they do, and that of so many other organizations here in Greater Boston, is driven by the kindness and generosity of everyday people, giving of themselves. That charity is one that our city has a long history of, going all the way back to at least the 1840s, when a ship loaded with food left Boston Harbor and sailed to Ireland. The USS Jamestown set sail to help with the Great Famine, and it became the first example of American humanitarian aid abroad. Boston historian Stephen Puglio tells the story of how our city led the way in humanitarian aid then and mapped a blueprint for America to lead on global aid. Puglio wrote about it in his book, Voyage of Mercy, and he joined us in April this year in the midst of the first coronavirus surge.
We began with how this effort was a perfect example of people showing up for each other in a time of crisis.
The Jamestown is the first ship to go to Ireland laden down with food donated by ordinary Americans of all stripes. And it really leads this effort. It's the first step in this effort that America engages in over the next 15 months, in which they donate about 10,000 tons of food to Ireland over 15 months with about 150 ships crossing the Atlantic with food. Americans take the suffering in Ireland very personally and donate food that they were growing, essentially, at that point, for their family and to keep their family alive and to feed their families, or to take to market and buy goods for their families. Instead, in many cases, they donated this food to Ireland.
So take us back. Just how bad was the situation in Ireland in the 1840s?
So the Irish famine, the Great Famine of 1847, the Great Hunger, as it's sometimes called, was devastating to Ireland. It really starts in the summer of 1846, when the Irish potato crop is destroyed by fungus, by blight, and famine sets in very quickly. Keep in mind, at this point, about 30% of the Irish people depended exclusively on the potato. And so when it does fail, when the crop fails, famine sets in quickly by the fall and into December of 1846. By 1847, it's devastating and people are starving. The famine ultimately would kill about 1.2 million Irishmen in a population of about 8 million. And another 1.3 million or so would flee, would emigrate. So the Irish population at the end of the famine, if you will, and some people put that at 1851, was really devastated and cut by somewhere between 25 and 30%.
So I want to go back. You talked about people taking the food, people in the United States, in Boston, taking the food they were growing for themselves and sharing it. The 1840s, as I understand it, was not an overwhelmingly prosperous time for the United States. We were a relatively young country and a relatively young economy. That really does sit kind of in stark relief in one's head to the image of people hoarding toilet paper or buying hand sanitizer and reselling it at $50 a bottle. This was a time when Americans really showed up for the needs of other people.
Yeah, I think they did. And I think at this point in time, the mid-40s here in the United States, there's this real feeling in America, because we're expanding, people are moving westward. It's a couple of years before the gold rush. 1846 was really called the year of decision, as lots of people made their way from east to west. And there's a real feeling in the country that we have a great deal of abundance. We have a lot of arable land, we have navigable rivers, and that we have an obligation to share it with people less fortunate. There's a very strong religious element here, and I mean all religions. So, of course, you might think it likely that the Catholics would be involved helping Ireland, but Jews, Quakers, Methodists, Presbyterians, Lutherans, Unitarians, really all set aside what at that point were their fears of Irish popery in the Roman Catholic Church, at least temporarily, in the name of this humanitarianism, which is really a phenomenal, moment in history.
And Congress moved heaven and earth to get this done as well. I mean, that warship was kind of an unprecedented move, wasn't it?
Yes, totally unprecedented. And they did move very, very fast. There's a meeting in Boston in February of 1847 in which the proposal is made to Congress to take a couple of warships, the Jamestown being first, strip it of its guns, retrofit it, and allow it to be turned over to a civilian captain, Robert Bennett Forbes, who would, transport this food to Ireland. And Congress approves this by the end of February. By March 17th, by St. Patrick's Day, Irish laborers at the Charlestown Navy Yard are volunteering their time to load food that's come in already. And the Jamestown set sail on March 28th. So you're right, they move at lightning speed to make that happen.
We did a little background research, and the government, the U.S. government in 2019 provided almost $40 billion in foreign assistance, which is less than 1% of the federal budget.
But on the other hand, Charity Navigator says total charitable giving by Americans in 2017 was $410 billion. Is that a shift in thinking from what we saw there because it's more private citizens donating, or is that the legacy of what we saw from there? Because while the government is doing a small amount percentage-wise, Americans are giving a lot.
No, I think you're exactly right. It's the legacy for sure. So you're right. The latest numbers I had was very close, $424 billion to charity given by private donations from Americans and overseas donations. So the federal government's around $50 billion in the humanitarian side. So that's taxpayer dollars. But then the American people donate another $70 billion from their own pockets from a charitable contributions, you know, corporations, religious groups, all of that, foundations. And so, no, I think it's the legacy of the Jamestown where the government had a part in terms of influencing and urging communities across the United States in 1847 to set up committees to help Ireland and to provide relief. But in large part, the vast majority of the relief is provided by individuals. So I think it's the legacy. I think you got it right.
And what do you think the lessons are for right now? I can't imagine that you haven't been thinking about this all the time with this book coming out now and the moment that we're in. How are you thinking about the lessons from this piece of history for who we are today as Bostonians and as a broader human people?
You mentioned the hoarding of toilet paper and all that, you know, not so great initially. But really what I've seen is a continuance of American generosity. So I see a lot here of people donating to food pantries, people ordering from their local restaurants takeout, because so many of these local restaurateurs are in danger of losing their businesses. People delivering food to ERs and first responders. Food is an important part of the effort now as it was then. And I sort of view what's happening now as a continuance or a legacy of the Jamestown mission. I see a lot of people helping others, and I'm really heartened by that part of it.
That's Boston historian Stephen Puglio speaking with us back in April about his book, Voyage of Mercy. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to this Christmas Eve edition of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We're spending this hour listening back to conversations around charity. Earlier in the show, we heard stories of charity in the most literal sense, aid and support, help given to those in need. Our next segment, charity takes on a whole new meaning, generosity of spirit, kindness, goodwill. And for Mimi Bull, coming to a place of forgiveness and acceptance of her life story. You see, Bull is a great-grandmother in her 80s, living in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and she lived most of her life in the dark about an uncomfortable truth. Her adoptive mother was actually her birth grandmother. Her adoptive sister, Florence, was actually her birth mother. And the Catholic priest in their Norwood parish, Father Hip, was her father.
Until my 81st year, I had never spoken with another priest's child.
This is Bull reading from a letter she sent in 2017 to Pope Francis.
I had tried to find others, like an orphan looking for one's lost tribe. Just as the secrecy deprived me of feeling part of either my mother or father's family, so the secrecy and shame has kept priests' children from the comfort and support of knowing one another. The Church, always cowardly in the face of scandal, hid and swept us all under the rug to save its reputation. It never failed to consider human fallout from its failure to acknowledge us, the blameless children, much less offer compassion for our plight. Not only did it render us invisible, but made it impossible for us to have the recognition we so needed from our fathers. I was strong enough and grounded in loving parents to fight my way to serenity and mental stability. Many others are not as fortunate.
Bull's letter got no response. Eventually, she turned her attention to telling her life story in a memoir, Celibacy, a Love Story. It is a story of great pain, secrecy, and shame, and a story of resilience and eventual peace.
We spoke with Mimi Bull in Studio 3 at the beginning of March this year, and we began with how she felt after she sent that letter to Francis.
Well, it was the first time that I had knowingly talked back to this institution that had completely governed my life until I got free.
Did Pope Francis ever respond to your letter?
Certainly not. I never expected it.
Are you mad about that?
No, I never expected it any more than when I called the chancery to ask them if they had a support system for children of priests. They absolutely shut me out. I don't expect anything, any kind of acceptance or recognition of any sort.
Were you adopted through Catholic Charities?
No.
Do you know
who... I know nothing about that period of my life.
Yeah.
I don't know where I was born in Philadelphia. I didn't get a legal birth certificate until I was in my 50s. I got my Social Security card and my passport on the basis of my baptismal certificate signed by my father.
I'm sorry.
Now that's...
Who is this book for, Mimi?
Well, the book's evolved because the story is so complicated in the timing and what was happening when and what did I know. And because our life was all over the world at that point, I wanted it clear for my grandchildren and now my great-granddaughter. And even my children sometimes ask me, did this happen? But then as time went on and the book was coming along and it felt important to tell this story, particularly for someone who had run the whole gamut from the intense secrecy of childhood and the very different feeling and then the intense depression and suicidality, its impact on my family, on my children, the ripples even to my grandchildren. And I just felt it was an important story to get out there as all the issues that are opening up at other aspects of the church.
There are several places in the book where there are actual illustrations of art therapy.
Yes.
That you did in your 50s.
Yes.
After you found out more about your story and started to come to grips.
Yes, I had all the details by then.
I found myself thinking in reading the book, was this book a piece of the therapy or recovery or healing for you?
Yes, of course.
When you were done writing it, did you feel different in some way?
Oh, yes. If you've grown up with the intense secrecy and the impact of the secrecy in all directions, you don't have access to half of your family. My maternal family, I was still off. I was still Florence's adopted daughter. So I had no... It wasn't until I began going home with my college roommates to begin to see what normal households were like with multiple siblings and, you know, a father and a mother who loved each other. I didn't know that. My father and mother loved each other, but I had no way. I never thought of them as my parents. And so...
You didn't know they were your parents.
I didn't. And so it was at that stage when I could finally embrace them as my parents and hope that I had fulfilled their dreams for me because they both sacrificed everything that I would flourish. And I did.
For someone who has not had the experience of being an adopted child, can you explain why knowing Florence was your mother gave you a connection to her that knowing she was a woman who wanted you as her child and wanted to raise you as her child when she adopted you,
yes,
wasn't enough?
Well, I'd had three. I had a foster mother for a year, and then I was adopted by my grandmother, and she was my mommy until I was six. And then my sister, Florence, became my mommy, my adopted mommy. And that had to be because she was unmarried. We were in a small town. And so that finally to offload all of the secrecy in all directions was to be whole. I'd never been able to say I love you because making that kind of commitment might be taken away from me. And suddenly to fantasize, as I do at the end of the book, standing with them and embracing them and saying, I hope that I have fulfilled your deepest dreams for me, is liberating.
Father Hipp, also your father.
Yes.
Died fairly young at 47.
Yes.
You didn't find out he was your father till much
30
later.
30 years later.
That is a lot later.
Yeah.
If you had found out while he was still alive, what would you have wanted to say to him, and what would you have wanted him to say to you?
I wanted him to say what my stepfather finally said to me. Daughter, I just needed that. And I just break up, you know, in performances of Lear, of Brunhilde's scene with her father, where he says, this is my beloved companion, my daughter. And I would thank them for the enormously interesting childhood they gave me.
If you could speak to Father Hipp, what else would you say to him?
I would have said also, I wish you had lived long enough to marry me to my husband. And they would have loved each other. They were both charismatic, wild men. They were wonderful. And I have a feeling that he would have told me then. Why my mother never told me, I will never, ever know. And she never was able to just offload all that stuff.
Is there a way back to the institutional church for you? And if there is, would you want that?
Not as it's configured right now. Maybe in a monastery there would be an extraordinary teacher. I wouldn't be averse to that. But as for, you know, there's a little Catholic church in Peterborough, but I don't know that I wanted to do it that way. I continue to read about the life of the soul, and I live my life as I have a mantra, Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace. And that's what I live by.
Mimi Bull. She's the author of Celibacy, A Love Story, Memoir of a Catholic Priest's Daughter, speaking with us back in March. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Dearing. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to this Christmas Eve edition of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing, and all this hour we've been listening back to conversations on the theme of charity in its most literal sense, the act of giving to others, generosity and kindness. Earlier in the show, we heard how Boston led the way in foreign assistance during the Irish famine, and how our government and everyday citizens are stepping up in this pandemic. Before the break, we heard from Mimi Bull and her fascinating story, full of a different kind of charity, forgiveness for the pains of childhood. Our next segment explores one more aspect of charity, grace in the face of adversity, kind judgment where so many might find anger.
This world is in trouble. This world is in its last days. This world is tottering, ready for its final fall.
This is the voice of Herbert W. Armstrong. He was the founder of the Worldwide Church of God. Now defunct, at its height, Armstrong's church had 150,000 members around the world. A pioneering televangelist, Armstrong broadcast his apocalyptic theology on more than 380 television stations. Herbert W. Armstrong died in 1986 at the age of 93. And he took the influence, his apocalyptic predictions and teachings, to his grave. But we're not about to hear Herbert W. Armstrong's story. It's the story of the power the long-dead Armstrong once had over Emerson College's Gerald Walker.
And just hearing that clip that you played, If you'd had some blood pressure machine on me at that moment, you might have called the paramedics.
Walker is a professor of creative writing at Emerson. This year, a finalist for the National Book Award. He grew up in Chicago, and his family joined Armstrong's Worldwide Church of God in 1960 and were members for 25 years. He told his story to Meghna Chakrabarty back in 2016 when his memoir, The World in Flames, first came out.
It's like recalling a horror movie you once saw as a kid and then seeing it again as an adult. And I heard that and I pictured myself in church hearing that voice, or in my parents' living room hearing the radio and television broadcast of this man proclaiming that the end was near. And it's a terrifying thing that I think I've recaptured in the 10-second clip you played.
So that we are now in the very last days of this civilization.
What was it like being a very young child and living in a household and going to a church where week in and week out you heard the message that your world was going to end?
It was terrifying in two ways. One, just the thought of what that would look like.
And he says definitely it is coming.
With the streets flowing with fire.
A war that could erase all human life, every man, woman, and child on this earth, but it will.
And people's bodies exploding from boils and other afflictions.
On this earth, and civilization as we know it will end.
That's A. But B, all of your friends who weren't a part of the church would be a part of that destruction. So you worried for your friends and what would happen to them when they were caught on the wrong side of God's orders.
Gerald Walker was a young black boy who prayed hard. He says he was a prayer zombie drifting through school, a child who once woke up in the morning still fully clothed, his face pressed against the open pages of his Bible. And if shaking in fear of the final days weren't enough, there's also this.
Armstrong was a segregationist, and he was a white supremacist, and he justified this position based on scripture.
You heard that correctly. Gerald Walker's family is African American, but they were members of a white supremacist religious cult run by Herbert Armstrong out of California. However, by virtue of living in Chicago's South Side in the 1960s, their congregation was largely black.
And what he taught us was that God ordained slavery. And he would say further that God had made mankind in the image of his son. Now, his son, according to Armstrong, was of course white. Therefore, in the hierarchy of humans and races, whites were necessarily at the top. Some blacks simply could not accept that that was the true word of God. Others felt, but Armstrong is his apostle. And if we reject what Armstrong is saying, we're rejecting what God is saying. And of course, God works in mysterious ways, and perhaps racism is one of them. And so we accepted it on the belief that God knew what he was doing. This was part of some master plan. Perhaps we didn't understand it all, but in time we would. We simply had to trust. Armstrong got so upset with blacks complaining about segregation and being second-class citizens in the church that he devoted an entire issue of one of his magazines called The Plain Truth to the subject of race. And in it, he chastised blacks for complaining about segregation, complaining about second-class citizenships, and he told us, and I have the copy still, that what we needed to do in order to stop being so unhappy was to stop counting our injustices and start counting our Cadillacs and televisions. That for being the descendants of slaves, we had made out pretty well, so shut up, was basically what he was saying. A consolation, I guess, in some ways, was that we were also told that when Christ returned and the kingdom of heaven was presented on earth, blacks would all be gathered up and be sent to Africa to rule there.
That was the promise of...
That was the promise. So the master plan of segregation would be executed in the kingdom of God, when everyone would be sent to their region of the world where their ethnicity predominated.
Well, okay.
So at least we'd get that. At least we'd get some real estate.
Walker knows what you're thinking right now. He knows what you desperately want to ask his parents.
What the hell were you thinking? I mean, what? How could you possibly do this?
The thing is, Gerald Walker's parents are blind. Both his mother and father had lost their sight as very young children. They were unable to see their own children. Walker used to wear bells on his shoes so that his parents would know where his little feet were prowling around the house. So consider this. Apocalyptic preacher Herbert W. Armstrong had a powerful and specific message. The Great Tribulation, he called it. The exact moment where his most fervent believers would receive the gifts they had most desperately prayed for. And that moment was to come in 1975.
By virtue of joining this church, which they did in 1960, if what Mr. Armstrong preached were true, then that would mean their sight would be restored at the return of Jesus Christ in 15 short years. That's powerful incentive for two people who had been blind for several decades and who, I suspect, above all other wishes, would like to see their children someday.
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking about this as a mother myself, and the overpowering desire to want to visually see your children is explanation enough to me.
It's as I mentioned, a powerful incentive to do pretty much anything, including joining a doomsday cult of a white supremacist. Like, so when I went to bed at night crying because it was thundering outside and I thought, this is it, as I did whenever I heard thunder, a part of me also thought, well, my parents are going to see you again soon. Mm-hmm. And this is going to be good for all of us.
To this day, Gerald Walker remembers those years waiting for the Great Tribulation. He remembers being an 11-year-old boy, feeling the soft touch of his mother's fingers on his face, hearing her call him, "my handsome boy." But of course, waiting for the miraculous disappearance of their physical blindness created a kind of metaphorical blindness in his parents. They could not see the pain and confusion the church caused in their handsome boy, that deep-in-your-gut feeling that something is very wrong with the delicate doomsday bubble you're living in.
We never saw ourselves as African Americans. We saw ourselves as Israelites. We were members of the church first, not members of a race.
Had you internalized then that message of white supremacy and black inferiority?
Well, I didn't question it. I was pretty young at the time, but yes. In fact, when the television series Roots was aired, I didn't really want to watch it because I didn't see its relevance to my life. Had there been a show on television called Noah and His Descendants, I would have said, oh, our heritage. I mean, that made more sense to me. But so Roots didn't make a lot of sense to me as something that I should be connected to. But I watched it nonetheless. And I think maybe that was the beginning of my awakening, that something was kind of not right. Because watching these people on television who looked like me, who looked like my family going through these hardships, moved me emotionally in a way that I hadn't anticipated would happen. And so I felt, just by watching this story unfold, that something wasn't quite right with how my life had been positioned in American culture.
1975 came and went. The Great Tribulation did not come. What came instead was a 1979 lawsuit filed by the California Attorney General, alleging very earthly corruption of church finances. Gerald Walker's brother Tim laid down a hard truth, saying, "The church is half con and half cult."
When I finally realized that it had all been a fraud, that I had had my identity taken from me before it even had a chance to take hold, that this man who was a racist and a segregationist and who was ultimately on the financial take had sort of ruined the grounding that I needed in order to be the kind of person who now I'm being asked to be.
Yeah.
And that's a citizen of this country who's proud of his life, of his heritage, of all of that. Well, how do you do that without a foundation?
Walker cast himself out of the church in 1979. a 15-year-old black teen suddenly bereft of both mooring and bearing in the absence of an angry white god.
I mean, if you have, as a part of your unofficial title, Gerald Walker, the Chosen One, then you're necessarily better than the people around you who weren't chosen. So when that's yanked away, and now you have this complete void, so what do I do now? At age 16, when I don't know really what it means to be an African American, I never anticipated having to choose a career or some interest or anything beyond the age of 12. So now what do I do? Again, my brother Tim, I go back to him because he's central. He encouraged us to be black, and being black to him meant selling drugs and being a delinquent. And so that's what we pursued. And so when I dropped out of high school when I was 16 years old and spent the next 8 years abusing drugs, myself and everyone around me, until I came very close to losing my life by the age of 22 years old.
Gerald Walker is a successful writer and professor today. So, in a way, even outside the church, his story has a biblical arc, a personal revelation, apocalypse, and redemption. But what of his parents? They left the church about 5 years after their son, but Walker says he never talked about that time with his father, who died in 2005. And of course, both his parents never did regain their sight. His mother never saw her handsome boy with her own eyes. But perhaps he gave her a different kind of gift, the gift of seeing the world through his eyes.
It wasn't until I started writing this book that I began talking with my mother about it. And when I would write a chapter and call my mother to read it, she would say, very remorsefully, "I can't believe we believed that stuff." And when I set out to write the book, I think maybe this is one reason why I delayed doing so for so long. My fear was that I would write a book that would be condemning of my parents. And I didn't want to do that. And I teach creative writing. And I tell my students, I do have a philosophy about what it is that memoirists should do. That when they write about people who have in some way done something unjust to them, that if you can't find some way to pull someone from the precipice, I use this in my classes actually, the precipice of the lake of fire, I use that terminology, they have no idea what I'm talking about, but I use it, that if you can't find a way to save them, don't write about them. And so I didn't want to write this because I didn't want to write this sort of scathing critique of my parents' choices. But in writing the book, I began to see my parents in an entirely different light. And I felt that by the time I finished the book, that I had, in fact, pulled my parents from the precipice of the lake of fire. And they had simple aims that were ultimately designed to benefit their family. Yeah. Even if I was miserable going through it, in hindsight, I respect it, I understand it, and in many ways, I appreciate it.
It would be nice to end this story with an additional touch of grace. How beautiful would it be to hear that Walker has also forgiven Herbert W. Armstrong for his spiritual exploitation, racism, and greed. But Gerald Walker says he's all too human. That particular apotheosis is still beyond his reach.
I'm never going to write a book in which I save Herbert W. Armstrong from the precipice of the lake of fire. I will be there to shove him. And if that means that I am in some way not healed, then so be it.
Gerald Walker is a professor at Emerson College. He spoke with Meghna Chakrabarty in 2016 about his memoir, The World in Flames, A Black Boyhood in a White Supremacist Cult. That's our show for today. Thanks for listening. From all of us here at Radio Boston, we hope this holiday season brings you peace, understanding, and a new embrace of charity. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.